Please be seated. Well, first of all, my apologies for the delay. I just wanted members of the family for you all to have a copy of the record of inquest as immediately I've concluded today, so that you can take that away with you. So I've just been making sure that that is available to you, and I think the last ones have been printed off now. So I'm going to sum up the case and deliver my conclusion in this matter. Members of family, this is being directed to you, but please forgive me for not looking at you all. There are a large number of you, but also I'm going to be reading from my notes. Okay. So I'm going to start by just summarising the evidence that we've heard. And I'm going to deal with the Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302. So on the 10th of March 2019, at 5:38, that's the coordinated universal time, Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302, Boeing 737-8 MAX, registration ETAVJ, took off from Addis Ababa International Airport, bound for Nairobi, Kenya, Jomo Kenyatta International Airport. At the time of the departure, it had 149 passengers and 8 crew on board. To explain how the crash happened, I look to the accident investigation report prepared by the Federal Democratic Republic of Ethiopia Ministry of Transport and Logistics. As I have previously ruled, whilst I am not bound by the case of R on the application of the Secretary of State v. Her Majesty's Senior Coroner for Norfolk, known as the Norfolk case, I do adopt the principles set out in that case, inasmuch as there is no public interest in the duplication of investigations or inquiries. The accident investigators are best placed to carry out such an investigation. Therefore, in the absence of any credible evidence that their investigation into the accident is incomplete, flawed, or deficient, I will accept the findings of the EAIB report as to the circumstances that led to the crash of the Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302. So to summarise, at 05:36 and 12 seconds, the airplane lined up on runway 07 right, at field elevation of 7,656 feet, with flap setting of 5 degrees and a stabiliser trim setting of 5.6 units. Both flight directors were operation manual with lateral navigation and vertical navigation modes armed. At 05:37:17, the first officer reported to the tower that they were ready for takeoff. And at 07:37 and 36 seconds, the tower issued takeoff clearance and advised to contact radar on 119.7 megahertz. The takeoff, roll and liftoff were normal, including normal values of left and right angle of attack. During takeoff, roll, the engine stabilised at 94%. The takeoff and liftoff, as I said, were normal. Shortly after liftoff, the left angle of attack sensor recorded value became erroneous and the left stick shaker activated and remained active until near the end of the black box recording. In addition, the airspeed and altitude values from the left air data system began deviating from the corresponding right side values. The left and right recorded angle of attack values began deviating. Left angle of attack decreased to 11.1 degrees, then increased to 35.7 degrees, while the right angle of attack indicated 14.94 degrees. Then after, the left angle attack value reached 74.5 degrees in 3/4 of a second, while the right angle of attack reached the maximum value of 15.3%. The difference between the left-hand and right-hand angle of attack was nearly 59 degrees, and near the end of the recording, it was at 49 degrees. At 05:39 and 30 seconds, the radar controller identified the aircraft and advised to climb flight level 340, and when able to turn right, direct to a navigation waypoint near Lake Dukurna. at 0539.51, the selected heading increased from 072 degrees to 179 degrees. Erroneous angle of attack sensor data ultimately triggered the maneuvering characteristics and augmentation system, which repeatedly pitched the nose of the airplane down. After the flaps were fully retracted, the first automatic nose-down trim activated and engaged for 9 seconds, positioning the stabilizer trim to 2.1 units. The pilot flying pulled to pitch up the aeroplane with a force more than 90 pounds. He then applied electric trim-up inputs. 5 seconds after the end of these inputs, a second automatic nose-down trim activated. At 0540 and 22 seconds, the second automatic nose-down trim activated. Following nose-down trim activating, ground proximity warning system don't sink sounded for 3 seconds, and pull-up also displayed on the primary flight display for 3 seconds. At 0540 and 43 seconds, approximately 5 seconds after the end of the crew manual electrical trim up inputs, a third automatic trim nose down was recorded, but with no associated movement of the stabiliser. At 0540 and 50 seconds, the captain told the first officer, "Advise we would like to maintain 1/4000. We have a flight control problem." The first officer complied and the request was approved by the air traffic control. Following the approval of the air traffic control, the new target altitude of 14,000 feet was set on the MCP. The captain was unable to maintain the flight path and requested to return back to the departure airport. At 0543 and 21 seconds, that was approximately 5 seconds after the last main electric trim-up input, an automatic nose-down trim activated for 5 seconds. The stabilizer moved from 2.3 to 1 unit. The rate of climb decreased following a descending 3 seconds after the automatic trim activation. 1 second before the end of the automatic trim activation, the average force applied by the crew decreased from 100 pounds to 78 pounds in 3.5 seconds. In these 3.5 seconds, the pitch angle dropped from 0.5 degrees nose up to minus 7.8 degrees nose down, and the descent rate increased from minus 100 feet per minute to more than 5,000 feet per minute. Following the last automatic trim activation, and despite calculated column force of up to 110 pounds, the pitch continued decreasing. The descent rate and the airspeed continued increasing between the triggering of the fourth automatic trim activation and the last recorded parameter value. At the end of the flight, computerized airspeed values reached 500 knots. Pitch values were greater than 40 degrees nose down, and descent rate values were greater than 33,000 feet per minute. Finally, both recorders stopped recording at 0543 and 44 seconds. At 0544, the airplane impacted with the terrain southeast of Addis Ababa near Ajir village. Most of the wreckage was found buried in the ground. Small fragments of the plane were found scattered around the site in an area by about 200 metres width and 300 metres long. The damages to the aircraft were consistent with a high energy impact. All 157 persons on board were fatally injured. The flight control computer controlling the manoeuvring characteristic augmentation system is dependent on a single angle of attack source and the MCAS contribution to cumulative angle of attacks effect had not been assessed by the manufacturer during the functional hazard assessment. The functional hazard assessment of the MCAS considered the effect of undue activation of the MCAS on flight controls, It did not, however, consider the possible effects of underlying root causes on other systems, displays and warnings. The air accident investigation found that the manufacturer of the plane did not provide the operator with information and alerts related to the MCAS to help them understand the system and how to resolve potential problems. The absence of the MCAS description in the flight crew operating manual and the absence of the angle of attack indicator made it difficult for the flight crew to identify the problem and find the corrective measure to solve. We know that there had been a previous 737 MAX air crash, that was the Lion Air Flight 610, on the 29th of October 2018. This was some 19 weeks before this accident, and that had resulted in 189 deaths. The FAA AEG learned that the MCAS activated during the flight and may have played a role in the crash. Questions and clarification were sought by the Ethiopian Airlines of Boeing on the MCAS design and operational procedures of the flight crew operating manual regarding checklist prioritisation. The manufacturer did not answer all the questions, indicating that it was related to an ongoing Lion Air investigation. The EAIB found that the questions raised by the airline to be safety critical, and if the manufacturer had answered the questions raised by the training department through a revision of the flight crew operating manual, it would have significantly altered the outcome. I have introduced into evidence from the deferred prosecution agreement. I have accepted this document as an official document generated by legal process. Boeing have within the document made binding admissions. In this agreement, Boeing agreed that during the development of the 737 MAX, two technical pilots misled the AEG about the aircraft's MCAS operational capabilities in order to affect the AEG pilot differences training determination. It says in the DPA, the nature and seriousness of the offence conduct, which involved two of the company's 737 MAX flight technical pilots, deceiving the Federal Aviation Administration's Aircraft Evaluations Group about an important aircraft part called the Maneuvering Characteristic Augmentation System, that's the MCAS, that impacted the flight control system of Boeing 737 MAX. Through this deception, the company interfered with the FAA's AEG's lawful function to evaluate the MCAS and to include the information about MCAS in the 737 MAX FSB report and fraudulently obtained from the FAA AEG a differences training determination for the 737 MAX that was based on incomplete and inaccurate information about MCAS. The fuller facts, or the fuller statement of facts, was read out in court. I'm not going to repeat the details again, but I do take into account the statement of facts in its entirety. It was the deception by Boeing's employees that prompted the AEG to authorise a lower level of training for the 737 MAX, resulting in the promulgation of inadequate pilot training worldwide. This, in my view, is a serious and gross breach of duty. Turning now to the conclusions, the family have submitted that I should consider a conclusion of unlawful killing based on the fact that manslaughter can be established on two grounds, namely unlawful act manslaughter and gross negligence manslaughter. For the purposes of this case, although matters happened outside of England and Wales, I will apply the English law when considering who, when, where and how Sam, Joe and Ollie came by their death. It is agreed by all interested persons that the law has now changed, which prevents corporations being found guilty of gross negligence manslaughter at common law. Those representing Boeing have indicated that it would not be right for me to consider findings against Boeing's employees if they're not here. They said that they've not been able to participate in these proceedings or given interested person status under Section 47 of the Coroners and Justice Act. I don't accept that. Whilst it's unfortunate that they are not here, it is too late in the day to raise this as an issue. A conclusion of unlawful killing has always been on the cards. Boeing have been represented throughout. For them now to say, after the evidence has been heard, that they're not looking after the interests of their employees, and at this late stage, this now means that I cannot consider a conclusion of unlawful killing, is in my view incredulous. Boeing have accepted, through the deferred prosecution agreement, that a fraud took place, and I take the view that this is itself evidence that the acts took place. Whilst I may not be able to consider a homicide directly against Boeing, the company itself, I can consider this against the employees. Turning to unlawful act manslaughter, the test for this is set out in the case of Church. That says, where the act which a person is engaging in, performing, is unlawful, then if at the same time it is a dangerous act, that is, an act which is likely to injure another person, and quite inadvertently the doer of the act causes the death of that person by the act, then he is guilty of manslaughter. Unlawful, within that definition, means whether the circumstances in which the unlawful act was committed made it dangerous, and the case behind that is the case of Long. I am satisfied that Boeing employees engaged in criminal conduct, namely a fraud on the FAA, during the development and certification of the 737 MAX. This fraud related to a safety-critical system. They deliberately misled an organisation involved in safety certification with regards to a safety-critical device which would create a risk of harm. The risk, in my view, would have been obvious and no doubt predictable. There is sufficient causative nexus on the balance of probabilities between this fraud and the crash, and therefore the test of unlawful act manslaughter is made out. Those representing the family have indicated that if the test for unlawful act manslaughter is made out, then there is no need for me to consider the test of gross negligence manslaughter. However, I think for clarity it is important for me to do so. The elements for gross negligence manslaughter are set out in the case of Rose. They are: the defendant owed an existing duty of care to the victim, the defendant negligently breached that duty of care, the breach of duty gave rise to an obvious and serious risk of death, it was also reasonably foreseeable that the breach of that duty gave rise to a serious and obvious risk of death, and the breach of that duty caused the death of the victim. And finally, the circumstances of the breach were truly exceptionally bad and so reprehensible as to justify the conclusion that it amounted to gross negligence and required a criminal sanction. It does not appear that there is any dispute that there was a duty of care owed to the deceased, or that the breach of that duty did not give rise to a foreseeable, serious and obvious risk of death, nor cause these deaths. What I have to consider is whether the circumstances of the breach were exceptionally bad and so reprehensible as to justify the conclusion that it amounted to gross negligence and required a criminal sanction. As already dealt with, the conduct breach centred around a safety-critical device and related to the provision of information and training for pilots. Employees of Boeing deliberately withheld information regarding the safety-critical devices from the FAA and those who operated the aircraft. These actions of these employees led consumers of the the 737 MAX being unaware of the existence of the MCAS system, and led pilots to not receive any or indeed adequate training in the correct safety measures to adopt in response to a system malfunction. I am satisfied, again on the balance of probabilities, that this conduct was something truly exceptionally bad and showed an obvious serious risk to life, and which showed a departure from the standard that would be expected, and so as to constitute the very serious crime of manslaughter. I therefore propose to record on the records of inquest as follows. I'm going to take all three together, and no disrespect is meant. I'm going to record that the names of the deceased were Samuel James Pegram, Joanna Helen Toole, and Oliver Charles Vick. The medical causes of death were multiple injuries. I'm going to combine box 3 and 4 of the record of inquest, and I'm going to record for each of them that they were unlawfully killed when Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302, registration ETAVJ, were travelling on, crashed shortly after takeoff from Addis Ababa Bole International Airport on the 10th of March 2019. The crash occurred because of the repetitive and uncommanded airplane nose downput inputs from the MCAS system due to the erroneous angle of attack input and its unrecoverable activation system, which made the plane dive with the rate of minus 33,000 feet per minute close to the ground. The contributing factors are, as they were set out in the EAIB report, but I will record them on the record of inquest. And they are the manoeuvring characteristics, augmentation system, design relied on the single angle of attack sensor, making it vulnerable to erroneous input from the sensor. 2, during the design process, the manufacturer failed to consider the potential for uncommanded activation of the MCAS, but assume that pilots would recognise and address it through normal use of control column manual electric trim and the existing runaway stabiliser non-normal checklist. The operations manual part B and the emergency airworthiness directive issued after the Lion Air accident on the 29th of October 2018 included additional guidance but did not have the intended effect of preventing another MCAS-related accident. 3, while the manufacturer considered the possibility of uncommanded MCAS activation as part of its functional hazard assessment, it did not evaluate all the potential alerts and indications that could accompany a failure leading to an uncommanded MCAS. 4, the MCAS contribution to the cumulative angle of attack effects was not assessed. 5, the combined effects of alerts and indications that impacted pilots' recognition and procedure prioritisation were not evaluated by the manufacturer. 6, absence of the angle attack disagree warning flag on the flight display panels. 7, the 737 MAX crew difference computer-based training prepared by Boeing and delivered to pilots did not cover the MCAS system. 8, failure by the manufacturer to design simulator training for pilots with regards to safety critical systems like MCAS with catastrophic consequences during undesired activation. 9, the manufacturer failed to provide procedures regarding MCAS operation to the crew during training or in the flight crew operating manual. 10, failure by the manufacturer to address the safety critical questions raised by the airline, which would have cleared out crew confusion and task prioritisation. Those are the contributing factors which I've added to the record of interest and inquest that come from the EAIB report. But I will add as a further contributing factor, and that is from November 2016 to December 2018, two employees of the manufacturer knowingly and with the intent to defraud deceived the Federal Aviation Administration's Aircraft Evaluation Group, that's the FAA-AEG, about important aircraft part called the Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System, the MCAS, that impacted the flight control system of the Boeing 737 MAX. Through this deception, the company interfered with the FAA AEG's lawful function to evaluate the MCAS and to include the information about MCAS in the 737 MAX FSB report, and fraudulently obtained from the FAA AEG a differences training determination for the 737 MAX. This was based on incomplete and inaccurate information about MCAS. The last point within the contributory factors was taken from the deferred prosecution agreement, although I've altered it slightly to remove the fact that it was the company that interfered with the FAA's lawful function. Although I've just read that out, I apologise. On the record of the inquest, the word company has been taken out. Before I conclude these inquests, there is something more I would like to say. Whilst I have today been considering the circumstances of the death of Mr. Pegram, Miss Toole and Miss DeVic, and also Mr. Quesham, we should not forget that there were 157 people who cruelly lost their lives on the 10th of March 2019. This huge loss will be borne by their families and friends all around the world. For the four UK-based families, this process has taken over 4 years. It's been a long and difficult journey. I hope that through these inquests that you, as families, have felt that you've had a voice. I have today, and I'm sure that all those in court in this courtroom could not help being moved by the impressive lives that Sam, Joe, Ollie and Abdul led and the good work that they did. We also know that as a result of this crash, we lost a large number of other environmentalists and humanitarians who had dedicated their lives to achieve the goals of protecting the environment and promoting peace, dignity and equality. Many were on their way on that day to further these goals. The true impact of this loss on humanity may never be known. I'd like to thank all the family members for the dignity that they've shown throughout this process. And once again, I'd like to offer my sincere condolences to you for the sad loss, as I say, of Sam, Joe, Ollie and Abdul. Before finishing, I would also just like to offer my thanks to the UK DVI team who helped coordinate the body recovery at the scene and helped to ensure that those involved in the crash were repatriated not only back to the UK but to other home countries. I know for the families things did not go as smoothly as they would have liked, but I would like to extend my thanks to the individual Sussex Peace officers who were all volunteers who attended and who had to work in the most challenging of environments. Finally, I'd just like to thank all the advocates for the assistance they've given me today, and I will now formally close the inquest into the deaths of Samuel James Pegram, Joanna Helen Toole, and Oliver Charles Vick. Thank you all very much. Thank you. All right.